All right, y'all, welcome to the show. We got big Super Tuesday results. We're going to get to that in just a minute. We have some massive changes in the race. We'll also get to Kamala Harris. Looks like she might be making a move on Biden. And what I mean by that is trying to replace him just a little bitsky. So wait until you hear the details of that one. Later on, we'll get to Jon Stewart torching the anti-immigrant fearmongers in the country. That's a really interesting segment. Charles Barkley shocks his co-host. Keith Olbermann has a mental breakdown on Twitter. And Trump finally makes some comments on Gaza. And guess what? It's way worse than whatever you could have imagined. All right, so there's a lot of stuff to get to. Let's go ahead and dive into it. By the way, everybody, please subscribe to the channel. It helps out massively and doesn't cost you anything. So Super Tuesday. Last night, Super Tuesday, we got our results in. And look, for the most part, it went exactly as expected. Donald Trump won many, many contests, although there were some he didn't, so we'll get to that. And Joe Biden won every contest. But again, there are things to read in the tea leaves, in the specifics, which don't bode well for either Biden or Trump in the general election, because they're showing some really clear signs of general election weakness. So here, let me break this all down for you. First, let's start with the Republican side. So Trump needs, all you need is 1,215 delegates to win the nomination. Trump's already at 995. Nikki Haley is at 89. Okay. Now, Nikki Haley, we'll get to this, but she just dropped out. She just came out, dropped out, but she didn't endorse Trump. Interesting. She hasn't bent the knee. Okay. So just to give you some of the specific results here, some of the contests that were very pro-Trump, Alabama plus 70. Trump plus 70. Alaska, Trump plus 76. Minnesota, not as much. Trump plus 40. You could see here, Nikki Haley polled 97,000 votes there, 28.8%. And, you know, you go down the list here, you'll find some that are overwhelmingly pro-Trump, and you'll find some that, not really. And the real comparison to make here is how much Trump finished up versus what the polls were saying he was going to finish up. Okay, that's the big story. So Nikki Haley ended up taking Vermont from Trump. Nikki Haley won Vermont by 4 points. It was 49.9% to 45.9%. So she pulled in about 36,000 votes. He pulled in about 33,000 votes. You know, this, of course, was a little bit of a surprise to everybody. A little bit of a surprise. Now, she also won the Washington, D.C. Republican primary, which, by the way, it was like 2,000 or 3,000 people that even voted in that at all. But that was a couple days before Super Tuesday. But, you know, you look at a place like Virginia, Trump plus 28, Massachusetts, Trump plus 23. Again, that might sound like a big number, but when you get to what the polls were showing he was up, it's actually he's really, really underperforming. Utah, Trump plus 15. I mean, that's Trump 57, Nikki Haley 42. So in other words, you are seeing some weakness here. Now, of course, there's, you know, there are examples. Texas, Trump plus 60. I mean, this is Trump country, right? Oklahoma, Trump plus 66. Perhaps unsurprising, but here's the specific apples to apples comparison. In Virginia, for example, the 538 average was Trump plus 49. The results, at least with 87% in, you had Trump plus 28. Okay. That's a big underperformance. So this goes hand in hand with what we've seen in every other contest to this point. Every single race, the polls say one thing, Trump comes in, he does win comfortably, to be clear, but he underperforms by 7 or 8 in the first state, underperforms by 7 or 8 in the second state, underperforms by 10 in the third state. Now you have some examples of him underperforming more than that, underperforming 20 points. And so again, what that shows is for a primary election, he's still the guy for the Republican Party. There's no ifs, ands, or buts about it. That's the guy that the base wants. But outside of the base, he's going to struggle for a general election. Okay, so now, this is Vermont. Nikki Haley won Vermont. I know that's going to annoy the shit out of Trump. He wanted a sweep. So this morning, Nikki Haley comes out and she drops out. I'll play a little bit of this here for you.
Just over a year ago, I launched my campaign for president. When I began, I said the campaign was grounded in my love for our country. Just last week, my mother, a first-generation immigrant, got to vote for her daughter for president. Only in America. I am filled with the gratitude for the outpouring of support we've received from all across our great country. But the time has now come to suspend my campaign. I said I wanted Americans to have their voices heard. I have done that. I have no regrets. And although I will no longer be a candidate, I will not stop using my voice for the things I believe in.
She goes on to say, look, I wish Trump well. I hope he can earn the votes that he hasn't got yet. She did not bend the knee. She did not say, I'm endorsing Donald J. Trump for president. And I got to be honest with you, that surprises me a little bit, because there were many signs early on that if she were to drop out, she would endorse Trump. But I guess what happened is that during the course of this campaign, maybe he crossed one too many lines. Maybe he was a little too disrespectful. And she took it personally, doesn't like it, and now is basically spitting in his eye and saying, all right, bitch, you wanted to treat me like that, I'm going to treat you like this, and I'm not going to come out and endorse you. And does that have consequences? Well, here's an NBC News exit poll in California. In particular, will you vote for the Republican nominee regardless of who it is? Trump voters, 71% say yes. 22% say no. Haley voters, only 26% of Nikki Haley voters in California say I'll vote for the Republican nominee no matter who it is. In other words, much less than half of Nikki Haley voters say, yeah, I'll vote for Trump in the general election. This goes hand in hand. Other states, we've seen the same thing. 59% of Nikki Haley voters in a poll during one of the previous contests said, I'm not going to vote for Trump if it's Trump. So again, he's got a lot of work to do. He's got a lot of work to do to try to get these people on his side. In fact, many of them have made up their mind that no way in hell I'm going to vote for him. I mean, look, maybe about 50% of them ultimately will. But if 50% of them don't, man, again, you tell me how that bodes for a general election. So here's a montage of some Nikki Haley supporters and what they have to say if it comes down to Trump.
Anything but Trump.
That was your priority.
That's my priority.
Is that the biggest reason you supported Nikki Haley?
Yeah, I'd say.
Because of Donald Trump?
Yes, yeah.
I would vote for Joe Biden over Donald Trump in a heartbeat.
Republican, I am.
What do you do when that is in? If he is the nominee and he and Joe Biden, what do you do?
I vote for Joe Biden.
I'm Nikki Haley. I think Donald Trump is a threat to the well-being of our country.
If she drops out, would you be disappointed if she endorsed Trump?
If she does, I'll vote Democrat. No. That's all there is to it.
It's important to me to keep Trump out of office again. Project 2025, I've read it. I've studied it. It's scary. It's frightening.
I've lived in a constitutional democracy all my life. I want to remain that way, and I want my grandchildren to grow up in one. Not a dictatorship.
And I'm curious, over the last two elections, have you voted Trump in the past? Was it something where you voted for him, you trusted him, and you were disappointed?
Yes, I voted for him in 2016. I am a registered Republican, and I regretted that vote almost immediately.
So again, you have this perfect storm of a very, very large number of Nikki Haley supporters saying, I won't vote for Trump. And in all of the contests, Trump has underperformed the polls big time. Minimum of 7%. Like I said, in some instances, it goes as high as 20% or a little more. I think the smarter Republican elites are aware of this, and they know they have a problem on their hands. Now, by the way, that's to not say, well, Joe Biden is really strong. We all know he has his flaws, too, and his Achilles heels. So what's interesting is, in the wake of Nikki Haley dropping out and her not bending the knee, and by the way, Trump releases a statement like right as Nikki Haley's giving her concession speech or like right after it, and basically says like, Nikki Haley got trounced last night. She got trounced. And it's like, hey, jackass, you maybe want to step aside, or you maybe want to release a graceful statement to try to start to mend the wounds. Trump doesn't have that in him. So Biden sees Nikki Haley's concession, and then he comes out and says, quote, Donald Trump made it clear he doesn't want Nikki Haley supporters. I want to be clear, there is a place for them in my campaign. I know there is a lot we won't agree on, but on the fundamental issues of preserving American democracy, on standing up for the rule of law, on treating each other with decency and dignity and respect, on preserving NATO and standing up to America's adversaries, I hope and believe we can find common ground. So from a tactical standpoint, from a strategic perspective, what Biden is doing here is very similar to when Trump in 2016 said some kind words about Bernie Sanders supporters in an attempt to pick them off. Now, ultimately, there weren't many Bernie Sanders supporters who voted for Bernie in the primary and then Trump in the general election. But there was a strategic effort to say, hey, our tent is big enough. You're welcome over here. We know you guys don't like Hillary. And Biden is now doing the same thing with Nikki Haley supporters. So strategically, this actually makes a lot of sense. But I will say substantively and policy-wise, it's not a great sign that you're welcoming with open arms diehard neoconservatives while at the same time snubbing your base over and over and over and over. Okay, so now let's talk about Biden. Well, actually, first, I want to go to some of the official numbers here from Biden. So, in a bunch of states, Biden absolutely crushed it. You know, Arkansas, Iowa, that was Biden plus 84 and Biden plus 87. But then there are other examples. Wherever you had uncommitted on the ballot, it appears like there was a pretty sizable protest vote. So take Minnesota, for example. Biden was plus 52. Okay, that means uncommitted got 18.9% of the vote. This is also Dean Phillips' home state. He ended up getting 7.8% of the vote. This is one of the few areas, by the way, where Dean Phillips actually topped Marianne Williamson. In most instances, it was Marianne Williamson who was beating Dean Phillips. But 18.9% for uncommitted. That is a strong showing for uncommitted. And that, again, is a sign that the base is not very happy right now. By the way, in Minnesota, you have Ilhan Omar's district, a very Muslim-American district, and they clearly are fed up over Gaza. North Carolina, Biden plus 75. This is another area where there no preference was on the ballot. That got 88,000 votes. That's 12.7%. Again, some cracks in the foundation. What's interesting is that it seems like the more conservative the state, the better Biden did as a percentage, right? So Tennessee, Biden plus 84. Alabama, Biden plus 83. Maine, Biden plus 83. But Massachusetts, Biden plus 73. So again, I'll show you some of the specifics here. You have Biden gets 82.8%, but no preference, 9.4%. Dean Phillips, 4.6. Marianne Williamson, 3.2. So now I'll give you, Crystal made a little list here that we can look at. Super Tuesday states with largest anti-Biden protest vote. In Minnesota, it was Biden 71%, uncommitted 19%, Dean 8, Marianne 1. Massachusetts, Biden 83%, no preference 9%, Dean 5%, Marianne 3. Colorado, Biden 84, uncommitted 8, Dean 3, Marianne 3. North Carolina, Biden 87, uncommitted 13. Dean and Marianne were blocked from that ballot. I remember that. The Democratic Party just went full authoritarian and said, we're not going to allow you on the ballot because we don't want you on the ballot. But guys, here's the problem Biden's facing. In these states that have uncommitted, when you add up the uncommitted number with the Dean Phillips and Marianne Williamson support number, when you add that together, in a lot of these states, that margin is bigger than the margin that Biden won those respective states by. That's a problem. That's a problem. That means that if Trump holds down the same numbers he got in 2020, that Biden can lose the election. Now, is Trump going to hold down those numbers? That's yet to be seen. Like we just described, he has 14 Achilles heels as well. But what we're seeing here yet again is a situation where on the Republican side and the Democratic side, you have a candidate who appears to be unbeatable. But that same candidate is also the weakest possible candidate for a general election. It's like a can't win with him, can't win without him type of thing. Okay, so this was an interesting development. Biden loses American Samoa Democratic Caucus. Who did he lose to? Some dude by the name of Jason Palmer? Literally nobody knew who Jason Palmer was before last night. Like, nobody. I cover politics for a living, and I was like, who? Who are we talking about here? Went to his Twitter page. I'll play for you who this guy. He looks like he's AI generated. He is the Democratic version of Doug Burgum. All right, let's watch some of this.
America needs an upgrade. We started with a beautiful vision for what we could be: freedom, opportunity, equality, justice for all. but I think we all know something's not working, and we can't find answers in the past. Young Americans keep telling me you feel particularly disenfranchised, and I can't blame you. Growing up in the shadow of 9/11 and a global pandemic, believing your parents had a better chance of getting ahead than you, somebody's got to champion you as the future of this country. I'm Jason Palmer, and I'm entering the 2024 presidential race because I believe we can do better for you and future generations. We have an ambitious and innovative plan to get us there, and we need your help. Our plan is people first. It requires upgrading our nation's system to become a talent economy, powered by mission-driven entrepreneurs and conscious capitalism.
Oh, there we go. So it's like, wait for it, and tech bro enlightened centrist. Like, it hits you, editor. Conscious capitalism? Okay. This is the kind of guy this is.
100% committed to core values like kindness, respect, and inclusion.
I'm running on kindness, bro. I'm pro kindness, bro. Vote for me. What are we doing here? What are we doing here? Jesus, man.
Got to change the way we behave in our national politics. My decades of experience as a founder, a turnaround leader, and an impact investor has shown me the power of well-run organizations focused.
Oh, okay, I've seen enough. By the way, this guy worked for the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. He was either involved in a hedge fund or private equity or something. But, you know, you see the kind of guy he is. Now, how did he win American Samoa? I could tell you my theory. Now, this is all speculation, but in the 2020 Democratic primary, you know who won there? Michael Bloomberg. You know who came in second? Tulsi Gabbard. So one theory is they just vote for whoever the funniest candidate would be to win for the lulz. That's one idea. My idea is there's got to be some lax, even more lax rules and regulations over there because it's an American territory versus in the United States proper. And so maybe direct cash bribes, right? I mean, I don't even know the number of votes he needed. He needed like, what, a couple hundred votes or something like that in order to win this thing? So it's like, it's absolutely possible that somebody went over there from his campaign and started handing out checks. Hey, vote for our guy. Because nobody knows who the hell this guy is. Obviously, there's some sketchy ass backstory as to how this guy ended up winning. But anyway, there you have it. Jason Palmer. Still don't know who you are, even though you just won the American Samoa primary. All right. So now let's get to some non-presidential news. This one hurts. So in the California race for the U.S. Senate seat, Feinstein's old seat, here are the results. Adam Schiff, number one, 34.4%. Steve Garvey, the MAGA candidate, 30.5%. Then you have Katie Porter at 17.4% and Barbara Lee at 9%. Now, the way this system works is it's called a jungle primary, which means Republicans, Democrats, Independents, they're all on the same ballot. You vote for whoever you want. And then whoever the top two vote getters are in this primary, they then go to the general election. And what's going to end up happening in this scenario is it's Schiff versus Garvey. So the Democrat versus the Republican. And since California is overwhelmingly Democratic, Schiff is going to easily win. He's going to easily win. But why are the results as they look right here? Well, Adam Schiff had his PAC spend millions and millions and millions of dollars pumping up Steve Garvey, advertising for Steve Garvey, the MAGA Republican. Now, why did he do that? It was strategic because he wanted to make sure Garvey gets enough support to beat the other Democrats in the race so that Schiff could easily win in the general. So it was a really sleazy, dirty political move to basically manipulate the jungle primary. And it ended up working. He spent more campaign money on propping up the Republican than he did on his own campaign. So really dark gutter politics here. So undercuts the support for the lefty candidates, Katie Porter and Barbara Lee. Now it's Schiff versus Garvey, and that's a foregone conclusion. Schiff is going to win. So he got what he wanted, but he had to play dirty politics in order to do it. Now, that being said, you know, to Katie Porter and Barbara Lee, what I would say to them is, come on, guys, you got to be smarter than that. If you know he's going to play these dirty games, and you do, and it became very obvious and apparent, you guys have to sit down, you have to have a conversation, you have to make a deal. It has to be only one of you in the race, because that's the only way the left stands a chance. So in this situation, of course, the establishment corporate Democrat is super organized and strategic, and the left candidates are chaotic and disorganized, and now we don't even have, a left option for the U.S. Senate in California, and California is one of the most democratic states in the country. And we're going to get some, corporate goon in Adam Schiff? God, it's so pathetic. So there's a lot of blame to go around. I'm mad at Katie Porter and Barbara Lee for not talking to each other, making a deal, having only one of them run. But I'm also really mad that Adam Schiff is even allowed to do what he did here. Even allowed to spend a tremendous amount of money to prop up his MAGA opponent so that he could go against him in the general and guarantee himself a victory. So just terrible, terrible stuff. Now, guess what, though? Adam Schiff, when he gives his victory speech, pro-Palestine protesters were there to show him what's up.
I want to thank you all.
Someone came up and said to Adam Schiff, who was reading off a prompter, who was trying to stick to the prompter to wrap it up. He went and finished it up. These were people who came in, about five or six to start with, and said, ceasefire now, ceasefire now. Security ushered them out. And then another couple popped up, let Gaza live, let Gaza live. And then some more came in the middle. Security could not get them out, that they were scattered through the room here at the Avalon Theater and the nightclub. Go down there and pull down to the crowd for me, please. And you see that, you know, there's just a lot of arguing, a lot of disagreement. Again, they were chanting, free Gaza now, let Gaza live, ceasefire now, let Gaza live. And the protesters remain here in the center of this floor. So what was supposed to be a victory celebration and a scripted speech that Adam Schiff was reading off prompter, when no doubt he had carefully crafted a long time ago, was cut dramatically short. And
good. Good. He deserves it. He's massively pro-Israel. He's in favor of sending them money. He's in favor of sending them weapons. He doesn't believe there's a genocide going on, even though it's incredibly obvious that that is the case. I think he came out the other day and agreed with the Biden version of a ceasefire and the Kamala version of a ceasefire. Like, we need an immediate ceasefire for at least 6 weeks. Okay, that's not a permanent ceasefire. In other words, you're saying, go right back to the ethnic cleansing and the genocide. Horrible, horrible candidate. He was also, you know, he made his name by grandstanding and virtue signaling against Trump in meaningless ways. He's one of the chief Russia gators. So of all the ways to attack Trump and go after him, there's 1,000 ways that are legitimate. He picked one of the few ways that wasn't legitimate and was full of conspiracy theories and became a Democratic version of Alex Jones and Russiagated nonstop. So Adam Schiff is horrible. It's terrible that now we're going to have to deal with him for the next 30 years. As the U.S. senator from California, it's gross. All right, Dean Phillips wanted to humiliate himself again, so he came out and said, congratulations to Joe Biden, uncommitted, Marianne Williamson, and Nikki Haley for demonstrating more appeal to Democratic Party loyalists than me. Starting to think he has a thing for humiliation. Starting to think that. Okay. Now let's talk a little bit about North Carolina. This is a really interesting development. The just-nominated Republican candidate for the governor of North Carolina thinks Beyonce is satanic, says mass shootings are karma for abortion, called school shooting victims prostitutes, Jesus, thinks the moon landing was faked, thinks lizard people are real, called 9/11 an inside job, thinks American Idol is the sign of a new world order. Here's another quote from Mark Robinson, the guy who just won the Republican nomination for governor in North Carolina. This foolishness about Hitler disarming millions of Jews and then marching them off to concentration camps is a bunch of hogwash. So we got some flat-out Holocaust denial. Then here is same guy, Mark Robinson, saying that gay people are filth. Let's hear this one.
Transgenderism, homosexuality, any of that filth. And yes, I called it filth. And if you don't like it that I called it filth, come see me and I'll explain it to you.
Okay. And then we also have Mark Robinson defending Harvey Weinstein and Bill Cosby. Let's get a little dose of this.
I honestly believe, Chris, that is what the left is doing with the Harvey Weinstein, the Bill Cosby, the Matt Lauer. They have picked out an elite group of people that have committed these so-called sexual crimes or whatever kind of crimes they've committed or offenses, and they have thrown those people underneath the bus, eating their own, breed a spirit of fear in people so people will be afraid to stand up and speak up and get involved. because they want people to say, they know everybody's got something in their past. Everybody's sins come short of the glory of God. They know that.
They're trying to destroy our resolve and our will and trying to make us afraid to stand up and speak the truth. Don't let it happen, folks. Look at this stuff for what it is. This thing that they did with Kevin Hart and this thing all the way back, like I said, to Harvey Weinstein, to Bill Cosby's, all of them. It's all part of that same plot.
So this is a situation now where, because the Republicans picked such a psychotic candidate, North Carolina is now in play for the general election for Democrats. For sure. I mean, think like Herschel Walker, Carrie Lake. When you go with the Doug Mastriano, when you go with the insane candidates, that usually backfires in the general elections. And so we'll see what happens. But anyway, there are your Super Tuesday updates. The race is, of course, functionally over on both sides. But the main takeaway here is, even though it looks like a Trump versus Biden rematch, it is a race to the bottom. And there are huge, huge electoral liabilities that both of these guys have that make it quite a predicament in the general as to whether or not they can pull it out. And I mean, again, the first person to replace Trump or Biden, if the Republicans manage to replace Trump, they win. If the Democrats manage to replace Biden, they win. At this point, name recognition is honestly irrelevant, because if the person is ultimately going to be running for president and have just, you know, a year or whatever to get their name recognition up, a generic Democrat would crush Trump. A generic Republican would crush Biden. And I think all the evidence in the world is in your face pointing to that conclusion. Hey. So there's some trouble in paradise, y'all. There's something really, really interesting happening on the Democratic side. So the other day, there was an article. I forget which publication it was in. But there was a line in an article that basically said, well, Kamala Harris's view is that what's going on in Israel and Gaza right now, it's Joe Biden's decisions. It's not hers. She would do it differently. And as soon as I saw that, my spidey senses started going off. And I thought, huh, that's interesting. So she's not showing, like, unity with Joe. She's not trying to own the decisions with Joe. And the only way a line like that gets in an article is if there's a source close to Kamala Harris that tells a reporter that that's their perspective and position. And you would only do that if you want to distance yourself from what Biden is doing because you feel like it's a political loser. Okay? So after that article came out, the very next day, look at this, NBC News. Administration officials watered down Kamala Harris's Gaza speech before delivery. Three current U.S. officials and former U.S. officials said the National Security Council toned down parts of Harris's widely covered speech. The vice president's office denied it was watered down. So in the headline and the subheadline, we get, well, they watered down her speech. She wanted to go further, but they watered it down. But, oh, they come out and say, that's not true. We're denying that. Okay, let's go through it a little bit, and then I'll tell you what's going on here. Before Vice President Kamala Harris delivered pointed remarks Sunday about the need for an immediate 6-week ceasefire between Israel and Hamas as part of a deal to release hostages, officials at the National Security Council toned down parts of her speech. Three current U.S. officials and former U.S. official familiar with the speech told NBC News. The original draft of Harris's speech, which, when it was sent to the National Security Council for review, was harsher on Israel about the dire humanitarian situation in the Gaza Strip and the need for more aid than were the remarks she ultimately delivered, according to one of the current officials and the former official. Two of the U.S. officials said the initial draft specifically called out Israel more directly about the need to immediately allow additional aid trucks in. One of them described Harris's original language as strong but not controversial. The move to soften Harris's comments highlights how reluctant the White House still is to aggressively criticize Israel in public as President Joe Biden tries to maintain some influence over the Israeli government and secure a hostage deal. The current officials said that the changes were tonal rather than shifts in policy, and the Harris comments about a ceasefire, which were widely covered, reiterated Biden's remarks 2 days earlier and the administration's position on the war. Asked about the reports that the speech Sunday was watered down and made to be less aggressive, Kirsten Allen, Harris's communications director, said, "That is inaccurate." Allen also provided NBC News with a separate statement explaining Harris's stance on her remarks. So now this is the second article that has come out, which is an attempt to distance Kamala Harris from Joe Biden's position on Gaza. And the implication is, well, she's a little stronger on the issue, and she feels like all the decisions of the administration are not exactly correct. And so understand that Joe Biden owns what's going on here. Kamala, if she had her druthers, would go further. She would, you know, be stronger on this issue. So what do I think happened here? Now, this part is all speculation, but I've now seen enough in the media to come out and make this comment. My guess is Kamala's own people are the ones who leaked this to NBC News. They leaked it. They said, well, I mean, Kamala's language was even stronger than what she ultimately delivered, but she was forced to water it down. But they can't just come out and say it's us saying that. So they sort of come up with this convoluted backstory, and they also come out and deny it. So in other words, my theory is they're the ones, Kamala's people are the ones who come out and tell this to the media. Then they turn around and deny it so that this way, when Biden and his people read this, they have the plausible deniability to be like, hey, man, that wasn't us. That wasn't us. We didn't say that. We came out and said it was inaccurate. But what's really going on here is Kamala is trying to position herself for if Joe can't actually be the nominee, you know, if the DNC is unhappy and they want to make some changes, she's trying to position herself where, hey, she's better on this issue and this is Biden's biggest weakness. This is where he's hemorrhaging votes the most. So she's the vice president, so she would be the heir apparent anyway, and she's trying to clean up her image on this issue where he's the weakest. It looks like what we're seeing is the beginning of a move against Biden. Now, look, to be clear, it is too early to say that definitively. I'm just giving my opinion on it, but it's not a coincidence now that you've had, this is the second time on this issue, there's a hint of, well, I mean, obviously Kamala's better on this issue and Biden's the one who owns all the mistakes. The only reason you would do that is you're trying to position yourself for you to eventually become the person, you to eventually be the leader. Wow. And I have to say, if that is indeed what's going on here, it's very smart politics. It's very smart politics because they're saying, oh, she's stronger on this issue of Gaza, right? But then they're also giving just enough plausible deniability to say, we didn't say that. And so you can appease Biden and his team while also posturing to be the heir apparent and trying to fix the issue that they seemingly know Biden messed up the most. And by the way, there were reports early on in one of the speeches Biden gave after October 7th, when it was like 2 or 3 weeks into Israel's destruction of Gaza. Biden was going to give a speech and he wasn't going to say anything about Palestinians or Muslims. And Kamala Harris, according to reports, was like, you should have a line in there about how, yeah, we're against anti-Semitism. We're also against Islamophobia. And the Biden team hadn't thought about that. They weren't going to put anything in about Palestinians or Muslims. And Kamala had to bring up, like, put in a line against Islamophobia. And they're like, oh, okay, right, let's do that. And so again, that was an instance early on in this where she was trying to be like, hey, you know, I have better instincts on this stuff. I'm better on this issue. And now it looks like they're making a play here. So we'll see if it continues. Look, I'll say this. If there's another example where there's an article basically saying, like, Kamala's better on X, Y, or Z, then you know that's what's going on. And that's three examples in a short time frame. They're trying to position themselves as she's going to be the person if he needs to step aside or if the DNC wants to push him aside. That's what's going on here. And it's also a balancing act in the sense that she doesn't want to go so far that she pisses off the Israel lobby and then loses the support of elements of the establishment, right? But she hasn't done that yet. Because, oh, 6 week ceasefire, right? Like, it's the weaselly middle ground trying to appease the Israel lobby, but also just being better than Biden on it. You know what I'm saying? So, really interesting. This is the first indication I've seen of Kamala kind of, and her team, sort of making a play to position themselves for the future. All right, guys. So Jon Stewart did a segment on immigration. Of course, this has been a big issue recently. And the Democrats and the Republicans came up with a bipartisan bill to really crack down on immigration. It was a very right-wing bill on this issue. And so he's going to do a segment here where he goes after basically the anti-immigration fear-mongers and also exposes the hypocrisy of many of the people involved in this debate. Let's watch.
We now return you to your regularly scheduled presidential election year programming.
Fox News alert, America's border crisis boiling over.
Chaos at the border.
The never-ending surge of migrants crashing across our southern border.
No! Yes, every 2 to 4 years, we are reminded that we have a southern border. And it is porous.
There's a migrant crime spree killing Americans, and the president's an accessory to murder.
We are being overwhelmed. There is no word to describe this except invasion.
Illegal invaders invading America, pouring over our border. By the millions.
Criminals, rapists, murderers, child predators, and God knows who else.
God knows who else? I mean, statistically, a couple of them at least have to be podcasters. I mean, murderers. But point taken. I think my pants just shit their pants. And if you're thinking that these are just some Central American no-goodniks, think again.
The countries we know they're coming from. Iran, number one state sponsor of terror, their satellite country, Syria. Egypt, home of the Muslim Brotherhood. Afghanistan, home of Al-Qaeda. 10,000 plus from Russia.
Record numbers of Chinese men of military age who have come across our border.
The number of military age men that are showing up with military haircuts, clearly in shape. They say these guys are showing up with six packs and military boots.
They're clearly tight asses. I mean, there's not an ounce of fat on these motherfuckers. I am so hard right. I want to go down to that goddamn border and I want to get ass deep on these immigrants. I want to suck and fuck until I want to stick cash me outside. How about that? Wow. So we got. Crowd loves my dirty Phil impression. We got criminals. We got terrorists. Is there anyone else down there we should be worried about?
Anybody ever hear of Hannibal Lecter? He was a nice fellow, but that's what's coming into our country right now.
Wouldn't cannibals amongst them be the solution to the problem? Or are they fasting until they get to America? Well, it's clear hyperbole, but there does seem to be bipartisan agreement now that the border is a problem. There were 300,000 crossings in December alone. That's an all-time high, and that is not sustainable. But Republicans turned down the chance to pass a strong border bill supported by the Border Patrol Union because of how confident they are that fear-mongering will be an effective election year strategy. It's all about branding.
I call it migrant crime. I really call it Biden migrant crime, but it's too long. So let's just call it migrant crime, and everyone's going to know it's because of Biden.
We will call it from now on Biden migrant crime, okay? It's migrant crime. Migrant. Let's call it migrant. Biden crime. Oh, that's good. That's smart. Migrant crime.
It's a portmanteau. I'm not completely sold on migrant. It really just sounds like a migrant who's open to crossing either border. It's migrant crime. Migrant. Look, there are some undocumented migrants who are committing crimes, some of them horrific. But isn't that true for every demographic, including natives? I feel pretty confident there's still a lot of opportunity out there for our American homegrown criminals.
Okay, just by the way, to interject real quick, all the fear-mongering is so dumb. There was a study that came out, I want to say about 5 years ago now or so. It was a Cato Institute study. So these are like right-wing people. These are libertarian types. And they found that more crime is committed by native-born Americans compared to not only documented immigrants, but also undocumented immigrants. So undocumented immigrants and documented immigrants both commit crime at a lower rate than native-born American citizens. So all of the, like, fear-mongering over crime, it just statistically, it makes absolutely no sense. Now, if somebody does commit a crime and they are an undocumented immigrant, does it make sense to deport them? Sure. No problem with that at all. But let's not pretend like it's a bigger issue than it actually is. In the overwhelming majority of cases, the people who come in here are just looking for a better life and to get a decent job and to provide for their families. And oftentimes, they contribute socially and economically to this country massively. In fact, so many studies show that immigration is a positive economically for the country. Now, if people are worried about immigrant labor undercutting the wages of American workers, the answer is to legalize the immigrants so they can't undercut the wages. They can undercut it if they're undocumented. If they're documented, the same rules and laws apply to them as applies to American workers. Then there wouldn't be an ability to undercut it all anymore. So all of the arguments, it's just so dumb. Look, I understand that there's like a processing issue and an organization issue. But the answer to that is to flood the zone at the southern border with immigration judges and people who can adjudicate these cases quickly to determine who gets asylum, who doesn't get asylum, who's allowed in, who's not allowed in. It's just a funding issue and an organizational issue. But all of the fear-mongering about how they're MS-13 and they're gangsters and they're Hannibal Lecter and they're this and they're that, that is just factually untrue. And it's really annoying that because of the consistent fear-mongering among politicians and the media, this has now become the number one issue to Americans. Because apparently when you talk about something day in and day out on the news and act like it's the biggest problem in the world, people start to feel like it's the biggest problem in the world, even though it's not, even though it's definitely addressable. Again, all you have to do is send a tremendous number of immigration judges to the border and process these cases quickly. Have some new facilities down there. Maybe have some religious groups help people when they immediately cross the border so that they can get a hot meal and they can sleep in a bed. You know, I understand that they're overwhelming a lot of the infrastructure in these cities, but there are ways to address that short of let's become absolute psychopaths and just damn everybody to having no due process and kicking them out and sending them to places where they might end up dying, right? So anyway, great segment so far from Jon Stewart.
If it's enough of an issue that on Thursday, we had ourselves a good old-fashioned border off as both men saddled up and headed to the southern border. Trump headed to Eagle Pass and Biden headed to Brownsville. It was bitch-ass Cassidy versus the sundown kid. And Biden was fired up.
We're the United States of America.
Nailed it. He knew exactly where we are. Yes. He knew what country we were in. Bang, boom. This is the United States of America. I take back everything I said a month ago. Lay out your proposal, sir.
I understand my predecessor's in Eagle Pass today. So here's what I would say to Mr. Trump. Instead of playing politics with this issue, instead of telling members of Congress to block this legislation, join me, or I'll join you in telling the Congress to pass this bipartisan border security bill. We can do it together.
Ladies and gentlemen, the olive branch has been extended across the aisle in a show of genuine desire to solve this complex and vexing issue. Trump, your response.
Crooked Joe is the blood of countless innocent victims.
Look, I do have to say, though, Biden on one day will go out there and give a speech and say, Trump, let's work together in a bipartisan fashion to fix this border crisis. And then the next day, he's berating the media because you're not taking the threat of Trump seriously. The guy's a dictator. The guy's a tyrant. The guy's an authoritarian. The guy's an extremist. He can never hold power again. He's too out of bounds. And it's like, you have to pick one. It's one or the other. You can't do the, let me normalize you and work with you because you're a reasonable person that I can work with. You can't do that and then say you're also a dictator and nobody should work with you. That makes no sense. That makes no sense. And by the way, you see how Trump treats Biden and the Democrats, and yet you still, like, bend the knee, try to do the above-the-fray bipartisanship thing, and then immediately go back and forth to, he's a dictator, he's beyond the pale, you guys need to call him out for how extreme he is. It's unbelievable.
Oh, that's a no. Seriously, though, Crooked Joe. We still going with that?
Crooked Joe Biden, he's crooked. I took the name away from Hillary because she's no longer relevant, I guess.
Do you have to say everything that happens in your head out loud? It's been 8 years. You won. The woman's been through enough. Now you're going to take away her nickname now? What are you doing? But let me tell you something. Trump. I got serious there. You can't scare the Democrats. Because the one thing that the Democrats have are principles. When it comes to immigration, the Democrats hold to our country's cherished ideals. The eternal promise etched at the feet of Lady Liberty that speaks to our better angels.
The only way we're going to have a great future in America is if we welcome and embrace immigrants.
These people are folks that we should be helping. America welcomes immigrants.
We want people to come here, despite where they came from or despite the circumstances that drove them to this country.
This is a place where the Statue of Liberty sits in the harbor, and we say, bring us your tide, those who are yearning to be free.
Unshakable. Bedrock. American values of compassion and empathy. And there is not a damn thing that you can do to change that.
Buses arriving in New York City from Texas, one after another, filled with migrants seeking asylum.
That's all you got? Nice try, Texas, but you heard the mayor. We're New York City. How dare you? No disrespect. But you are never going to change our values because you're afraid. So keep sending those busloads because we got plenty of room in our hearts and in this city.
We have no more room in the city.
He's roasting the Democrats here. This is all fair, man. This is fair. This is what they do.
What about the yearnings and the tiredness? And the tiredness of those who are doing the yearning?
110,000 migrants. We have to feed, clothe, house, educate the children, wash their laundry sheets. This issue will destroy New York City.
Oh.
Destroy New York City.
I mean, they're supposed to be doing our sheets. What's going on around here? What kind of topsy-turvy world are we living in over here? Yes, it turns out in the age-old battle between values and fear, values never had a f***ing chance.
Yep. Yep. I mean, this is what we said when we looked at the bill, the bipartisan bill that came out for immigration. Usually what happens with these negotiations is Democrats say, all right, look, we'll give you some more border security, but in response, you need to, you know, look out for the Dreamers, for example. Have a path to citizenship for people who've been here for a while and they're contributing to society, etc. And there's a trade-off. Hey, here's what we'll give you on immigration, you give us this on immigration. This time, there was no trade-off. This time, the Democrats took their political capital and said, Republicans, you need to vote for increased funding to Ukraine and Taiwan and Israel, and in response, we'll give you whatever you want on the border. Total crackdown, super, you know, hardline stance, even revoke due process after a certain number of immigrants get across the border. So no more rules and regulations, forget the Constitution, due process, my ass cheeks, we don't need that. So they gave Republicans everything they wanted on the border and said, in return, you just have to vote for the Ukraine money and the Taiwan money. And to be fair, both parties want a tremendous amount of Israel money, and so they were both on board with that. But there was no trade-off within the issue of immigration. It was just all Republican ideas. And so, yeah, this is going to be the reaction when you do that. When you totally give in to the framing of the right and say, I just agree with you on the issue, well, then you don't believe in anything. And any of the noise you make, you know, when you might be campaigning or trying to appeal to your own base about, oh, we're a country of immigrants and all that stuff, you clearly don't mean any of that stuff or care about any of that stuff. And this is the reality. Now, by the way, it is fair to point out, if you're one of these Democratic mayors or governors or whatever, it is the federal government's responsibility. They are not picking up the slack that they need to pick up because the border is a federal issue. That's been determined in court. And so they really do need to pick up the slack and fund more services at the border and get more judges down there and all that stuff. So it is on them. But the amazing 180 that happens in a situation where some busloads of immigrants come in. Again, it just exposes them that, what's that old saying that the left likes to use? You cut a liberal and a fascist bleeds or something like that? I mean, maybe that's a little hyperbolic for this instance, but certainly you cut a liberal Democrat and a moderate Republican is underneath, right? Like, you don't even need to cut them. There just are moderate Republicans. And he's calling that out very effectively here. So, hey, it turns out when you go into an election year and one of your main positions is my opponents are right on immigration, that might help the opponents. Why would they go with your cheap knockoff version when they got the original right there and you're saying the original is correct? Man, it's really embarrassing. There are many ways to have an interesting, accurate, intelligent perspective on the border, and all that's out the window now among the Democrats. And Stewart did a phenomenal job calling that out. All right, guys, let's have some fun. So Charles Barkley, you know, he's got this new CNN show. Now, me personally, I'm the biggest fan of NBA on TNT, where it's Shaq and Kenny and Chuck and EJ. I think that's the best show on TV. They're hilarious. They act like there's not even cameras on them. I mean, they just say whatever the hell comes to their mind. That's what makes for good TV. They're funny. And so I was hoping that Charles Barkley would bring that energy to CNN. Now, look, to be fair, to this point, he's a little more straight-laced on this show, but for understandable reasons. I mean, in his mind, he's like, this is CNN. This is not TNT. It's a different audience. And so Gail King is his co-host, and you know, she plays the very straight-laced person who tries to keep everything on the tracks, the same role that EJ plays for NBA on TNT. And, you know, to this point, there hasn't been too many, like, noteworthy moments from this show. Now, I told you guys, when we learned that this show was going to happen, I told you he's got to bring that same energy he has on NBA on TNT to CNN. Because what's missing from CNN is, like, humanity and authenticity, right? And normal, real talk. And I just wish they gave a show on CNN to all the guys who do NBA on TNT. Could you imagine, like, Shaq and Kenny and EJ and Chuck talking about politics? Oh, it'd be the funniest thing ever. And I don't care that, like, if Shaq doesn't know anything about politics, who cares? Just let him go out there and say whatever the hell he wants. It makes it even better. So we got this moment from Gail King and Charles Barkley here. Gail King is going to play for Charles Barkley a clip of Trump recently. Remember the thing he said about black people and why they love him? You'll see it. They're going to play that, and then we're going to get Charles Barkley's reaction. And this is golden.
The former president raised a lot of eyebrows with these comments while talking to listen to the audience, a black conservative conference. He said this.
I got indicted a second time and a third time and a fourth time. And a lot of people said that that's why the black people like me, because they have been hurt so badly and discriminated against. And they actually viewed me as I'm being discriminated against. The mugshot, we've all seen the mugshot. And you know who embraced it more than anybody else? The black population. It's incredible. You see black people walking around with my mugshot. You know, they do shirts.
When you heard that, what did you think? Big sigh.
First of all, I'm just going to say this. If I see a black person walking around with Trump mugshot, I'm going to punch him in the face.
Charles.
No, Gail. Charles. Gail.
You really can't say that because, A, you don't mean that.
Oh, I mean that sincerely. I'm going to just tell you something.
And then you will be arrested for assault. And then what?
I'm going to bail myself out and go celebrate.
Don't encourage him. Okay, but go ahead.
Seriously.
Continue.
First of all, if I was at that.
At that conference, yeah.
I'd have got up and walked out. That was an insult to all black people. Because mm-hmm. He's basically just saying, and first of all, to compare black history where we've been discriminated against to his plight.
Yes.
Well, first of all, he's a billionaire. Mm-hmm. And they're prosecuting him for stuff he did wrong. And for him to compare.
It's still in the court system, Charles. We have to wait. It's still in the court system. But continue.
Well, some of the stuff is true. They did storm the Capitol. Did say that the election was stolen. Those aren't lies, Gail.
Yeah.
Those are
facts. They did say that.
But to compare, I would have got up and walked out because it's not a fair comparison. Mm-hmm. You know, he's a billionaire. He's had a great life. He's been president of the United States. To insult black people who have been discriminated against all these years, to put them in the same category, I was just offended.
That's awesome. Now, I don't know, to be fair, I don't know if the right has picked up on this yet to try to, like, make Charles Barkley the number one boogeyman. But that's going to be hard to do. Why? Because it was funny. Like, what he said was funny. And Gail King's like, oh, you don't mean that. And he's like, yes, I do. And, like, you're laughing, so it's hard to take it too seriously and be outraged in response. I'm sure if the right gets a hold of it, they will do that. But I haven't seen any of that just yet. I've just seen people, you know, laughing. So, a couple points. I love every point he made there. He's playing the victim. Like, dude, you're a billionaire. You were president of the United States. You were born with a silver spoon in your mouth. You say you inherited, like, a measly $2 million from your dad. That's not true. He inherited about $400 million. I can't think of a single person who is more entitled than Donald Trump. What's the saying? He was born on third base and thought he had a triple. And for him to compare the plight of black people in this country to what he's going through, as Charles Barkley points out, you did this to yourself. You did this to yourself. It's not some sort of witch hunt. It's not unfair. If anything, the justice system has let Trump get away with stuff for far too long. Even take the classified documents case that he stole and hid in the bathroom at Mar-a-Lago. They gave him like a year or a year and a half to give everything up, and he didn't give everything up. So yeah, there is a two-tier justice system, but not in the way Trump thinks. Trump thinks there's a two-tier justice system and that they're harder on me than everybody else. No, they're easier on you than anybody else. And we just saw with the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court said, forget the plain face reading of Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. Forget that it's the insurrection clause and you committed insurrection or aided and abetted the people who did commit insurrection. We're going to throw out the plain face reading and say you're allowed on the ballot. How's that bias against you? That's bias in favor of you. And to Gayle King, she's trying to like temper him here and make sure Charles Barkley doesn't go too far. And she, oh, you know, allegedly it's in the courtroom, et cetera. We got to wait to figure out if he actually did these things. No, we don't. We already have a number of cases where we know he was found liable. There were two civil cases already that he was found liable for. The E. Jean Carroll stuff, he's got to pay $83 million over that. Then you have the fraud stuff, tax fraud, insurance fraud, business fraud. He's going to have to pay over $400 million on that stuff. Donald Trump is the only person in the world who could be found liable to pay over $400 million. And then you still have people walking on eggshells and being like, well, I don't know. We have to wait to see what happens before we can say whether or not he did something wrong. If Joe Biden had to pay over $400 million because of insurance fraud, tax fraud, bank fraud, and Lord only knows what the hell else, everybody would be like, oh, that's it. He's a terrible guy. He's done. This is way too far. This is unprecedented. This guy's supposed to be a leader. He's supposed to be the president. And look at all these horrible things he's done. Trump does it and it's barely a blip because everybody kind of expects it. They have a low bar for him. But the most important point is this. I remember it wasn't that long ago that conservatives used to attack liberals and leftists and say, you know what the problem is with you guys? You have giant victim complexes. That's your problem. And it's not true that you're victims. This is what they would say. So if you want, oh, you're going to play the victim when it comes to race issues. You're going to play the victim when it comes to gender issues. You're going to play the victim when it comes to class issues. You guys are nothing but victim narrative humpers. You just want everybody to think you're a victim. You want to bend society so that it accommodates you. Well, no, you need to pull yourself up by your own bootstraps. You're not a victim. Get over it. That's what the right used to say about the left. Now, you have Trump, the leading figure on the right, and his whole thing is, I'm a victim! I'm a victim! Nobody's ever been more victimized than me! And obviously, black people love my mugshot, because, you know, I'm a criminal, they're criminals, you know how this works, folks. You know how this works. That's the thing, folks. Oh my god. So, anyway, love this comment from Charles Barkley. It's hilarious. It's hard to hate somebody when they're using humor, you know, and he's good at using humor. I would say to him, let it rip, man. Say whatever the hell comes to your mind just like this all the time, because these are the moments that make the show interesting. And again, for some free advice for CNN, nothing against Gayle King here, but some free advice for CNN. Just bring in EJ, Chuck, and Shaq and let all of them talk politics for 2 hours. And then that would be the most watched show in the world, because that would be so hilarious in so many different ways. So there it is, Charles Barkley, as per usual, telling the truth. So we got some on-the-ground interviews from Fox News. This was during Super Tuesday, and they wanted to see, hey, what are these Republican voters thinking? Of course, you have Trump versus Nikki Haley. That's what it was. Haley has since dropped out. She was only able to win the state of Vermont and Washington, D.C. Trump won every other one under the sun. Now, she didn't endorse Trump when she dropped out, but it's interesting to hear these voters talk about what their thoughts are on Nikki Haley. These are Republican base voters. So first, let's go here to a diner in Allen, Texas, and just I'm gonna let this clip do the talking for itself. This is really something.
NBC just reported that Michelle Obama has said she will not run for president.
Thank God. Okay. Yes.
Ainsley said, I would love the reaction from a woman in the crowd. And
I wouldn't vote for a woman. And especially, you know, Nikki Haley, I'm just going to say this. She's probably menopausal. We don't need that.
Okay. She said, how about we vote for people regardless of their gender, just the right person for the job for America.
Bruh. When you are so extreme and so immensely sexist, even the Fox News host feels the need to clean up what you just said. She goes, I wouldn't vote for a woman. And then she goes, she's probably menopausal. We don't need that. Oh. And he's like, oh, yeah, what she said is, regardless of gender, you vote for who the best candidate is. That's not what she said. That's not at all what she said.
Ainsley said, I would love the reaction from a woman in the crowd. And
I wouldn't vote for a woman. And especially, you know, Nikki Haley, I'm just going to say this. She's probably menopausal. We don't need that.
Okay. She said, how about we vote for people regardless of their gender, just the right person for the job.
Oh, when the Fox News reporter feels the need to clean up your deep-seated misogyny. Guys, we got to keep it real. There's a massive, like, age gap in this country in terms of the way politics is thought about. I mean, The older the people are, you go look, don't take my word for it. There's a lot of polling on this. The older the people are, go look at their thoughts on like Israel and Palestine, right? Go look at their thoughts on gender dynamics and like religion. There's all these things. There's such a giant gap. She literally said into a microphone to millions of people, I wouldn't vote for a woman. And this particular woman is probably menopausal. I shudder at the thought of what this woman's life was like and what she was taught when she was younger by her own mom and dad. To me, this just, it stinks to the high heavens of indoctrination from a young age, right? Like, a woman's place is in the kitchen. It's a caretaker and, you know, you make sure the home runs smoothly. You're subservient to your husband. You don't make the decisions. Almost like that. You're like semi-property type thing. That's clearly the way she thinks. I wouldn't vote for a woman, she said. You wouldn't vote for a woman? How many women are in this country? Like 170 some odd million women in this country? I wouldn't vote for a woman. All of them? None of them? There's not a single one? Jesus Christ. All right. But we're okay. I haven't even gotten to the worst one. This was just the appetizer, y'all. I'm about to give you the entree. All right, you ready for this? So we got another one. This one is, I don't think this is Fox News. Is this NBC? North Carolina. You got a reporter who's going to ask this dude his thoughts. Watch this.
What do you think of Nikki Haley? Did you ever consider her?
You know, what I got to say, you don't really want to put it on.
Let me hear it.
Well, a woman's not going to be a good president. She have no balls to scratch. She's just going to scratch her head. All a woman's good for in my book is having babies and taking care of the house. But that's the old thing, you know. But I'm old school.
So you never even considered her?
No.
Mainly because she's a woman?
Because she's female. So, I mean, females, don't take me wrong, females know what they're doing, but they still got to have a little bit of guidance. Trump would be the one to guide her through the
Told you. I told you that first one wasn't even the worst one. This dude literally said a woman's place is in the kitchen and like taking care of the kids. The first thing he said was, I don't even know if you want me to say this on this camera. And then he let it all hang out again. One more time. This is wild.
You know, what I got to say, you don't really want to put it on.
Let me hear it.
Well, a woman's not going to be a good president. She have no balls to scratch. She's just going to scratch her head. All women.
She doesn't have balls to scratch. She's going to scratch her head. Is there something about scratching of a ball sack that makes you more intelligent or fit to lead?
Good for in my book is having babies and taking care of the house. But that's the old thing, you know, but I'm old school.
I'm old school. Like, for example, I think women are inferior and basically property. What are you supposed to do with this? Look, I have to admit, I'm the type of dude, I never put much stock in the idea of like this massive patriarchy that runs everything. You know what I mean? The idea that like a cabal of elite, powerful men have rules of like no women allowed in our club that runs the world, right? It sounds kind of goofy. It sounds like an overreach. But I will admit, I massively underestimated the amount of casual, deep-seated sexism there is out there. Like watching these two people, the woman saying what she said and this guy saying what she said, they're on camera and they're saying this. So how many people casually agree with this? How many people are like, yeah, that's right. That's the way it works. Women should be in the kitchen, you know, pop out the babies, shut the fuck up. Don't talk so much. Listen to your husband, you know, let him make all the decisions. You're no position to lead. You're female. I honestly thought that belief was like a 3% belief. 3 out of 100 people might say, yeah, that's what I think. But they found 2 in one day on a Super Tuesday, which made me believe, what is it really? 30%? 20%? Something like that, right? Man, that's dark. This is so dark. I can't believe people actually still think like this.
The house, and that's the old thing, you know, but I'm old school.
So you never even considered her?
No.
Mainly because she's a woman.
Because she's female.
That's amazing. So even theoretically, if Nikki Haley had all of the policies that this guy prefers, and she's with him on 100% of things, whereas Trump's only with him on 68% of things, he's still like, well, she's a woman. I can't. Why would I do that? Not to get all psychological here, but I would love to know what the relationship was like between this guy and his mom, right? Or that woman and her dad and her mom. Like, what went on to make you think in such a warped-ass way?
I mean, females, don't take me wrong, females know what they're doing, but they still got to have a little bit of guidance. Trump would be the one to guide her through the... What do you think?
They still got to have a little bit of guidance. Whereas Trump, he needs no guidance. He's got it all figured out, that guy. The guy who has to pay over $400 million because he committed 17 different kinds of fraud. Real intelligent guy who doesn't need any guidance whatsoever. Oh, man. Yeah, man, what a gap there is between what I thought people thought and how they actually think. Like, I don't want to overstate it. There's only 2 people. But then again, I thought we're at the place where nobody would be dumb enough to say something like this in public, right? We got 2 of them in one day on a Super Tuesday, which leads me to believe how many actually think like this. It's got to be a decent number, right? It's got to be a decent number. So Keith Olbermann had a pretty giant meltdown and tantrum on Twitter recently. This was specifically over the Supreme Court's decision to allow Trump on the ballot in Colorado, which means by extension that he's going to be allowed on the ballot everywhere. This really isn't just a decision for Colorado. It's for all the states that kicked him off. And I believe we were up to 4 states that had said Trump is not allowed on the ballot because he violated Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. So let me walk you through this here. This is kind of funny. Title here, Mediaite. Keith Olbermann calls for SCOTUS to be dissolved. Based? Based? Not based? I'll leave it up to you guys. We won't get too deep into that now. That could be a video all on its own, whether or not the Supreme Court should be dissolved. In tantrum over Trump's victory in ballot case. Those aren't tears, fascist. They're urine. What? All right, I'm a little confused about that one. All right, let's dive into it. Former ESPN and MSNBC personality Keith Olbermann did not take the U.S. Supreme Court's unanimous decision to put Donald Trump back on the ballot in stride on Monday. In a per curiam decision, the court ruled that the Colorado Supreme Court erred in disqualifying Trump from the state's presidential contest because the states aren't empowered to enforce the insurrectionist clause in Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. On X, formerly Twitter, Olbermann reacted with fury, laying into all the justices, including Democratic appointees Ketanji Brown Jackson, Elena Kagan, and Sonia Sotomayor, Here, I'll read his tweet for you. I'll do it in his voice. The Supreme Court has betrayed democracy. Its members, including Jackson, Kagan, and Sotomayor, have proved themselves inept at reading comprehension. And collectively, the court has shown itself to be corrupt and illegitimate. It must be dissolved. That sounded like a mix between Keith Olbermann and a professional wrestler in 1993. That's what that voice sounded like. All right. I'll give you some more. The Supreme Court is full of shit, Olbermann insisted in another post, but that was merely a prelude to his masterpiece, which came in response to a reply from a right-wing influencer who urged him to, quote, cry more, and then pointed out that the decision to reinstate Trump was unanimous. Okay, so this right-wing guy named Gunther Eagleman, come on, man, that almost sounds like an AI-generated fake-ass account. It could be a bot, I don't know. Cry more, 9-0. Olbermann responds, those aren't tears, fascist. They're urine. I'm sure you enjoy being bathed in it. What? Oh, man, what a swing and a miss. Holy shit. Those aren't tears, fascist. They're urine. I'm sure you enjoy being bathed in it. Okay, so I get that he's saying, I'm not crying, and you're a fascist. And then when he says they're urine, I'm sure you enjoy being bathed in it. But that would imply urine's on your face. Because if it's tears, it would be on your face. So the urine would be on your face. So there's urine on your face, but you're saying he enjoys being pissed on? There was some debate in the replies over what exactly Olbermann was implying. Oh, I remember this from Happy Gilmore. When the guy's like, I eat pieces of shit like you for breakfast. And Happy Gilmore says, you eat pieces of shit for breakfast? And he's like, no. That is what it's like. Keith, this comeback doesn't make any sense. It implies you're pissing on yourself. But Olbermann ignored the noise and just pressed on, decrying the influence of that motherfucker Scalia, a reference to the late Justice Antonin Scalia. Look, this is one of those instances where even if the heart of what you're saying, even if the general sentiment of what you're saying is true, if you're too unhinged and too cringe, you come out looking like the loser, bro. And that's what happened here. Because he's actually on the substance of the case. To say nothing about, you know, he said dissolve the Supreme Court. Put that aside. That's another debate for another day. Putting that aside, on the substance of this case, I actually agree with him. I think it is kind of an absurd decision. But he was so unhinged. It was such a tantrum and a meltdown. And it was such a horrific comeback to that dude. Man, you are ripe for looking like the loser in this scenario. Oh, that did not work well. By the way, I mean, this is the thing about Keith Olbermann, right? I mean, there's been 1,000 stories. This guy's worked ESPN, MSNBC, Current TV, the old like left-wing network that Cenk Uygur was at. And word is from everybody who's ever worked with him, oh, this dude is absolutely batshit crazy. However unhinged he looks on social media, inject that with steroids and human growth hormone, and that's what he's like in real life. Totally impossible to work with, incredibly demanding, yells at everybody around him and people who, you know, he of course is supposed to be kind to and nice to his own workers. Totally unhinged. And you know what? It comes across really, really clearly. And now it's even spilled over into, I feel like his public persona, he was able to kind of mask it for a while. Now ain't no masking it. Ain't no masking it. Remember, what was he doing? He was doing these videos for like GQ and they were the cringiest things I've ever seen in my life. Like, and it was during the Trump era, and he somehow found a way to make, like, the anti-Trump perspective look totally deranged, even though it's not. So at this point, he's not helping, right? He had his moment. Keith Olbermann had his moment. I was in during the Iraq War, kind of early on in the Iraq War, he was the first voice to come out on MSNBC and say, this is an illegal war. This is an offensive war. George W. Bush is a war criminal. Dick Cheney is a war criminal. We're doing torture. You know, we attacked literally the wrong country. Iraq had nothing to do with 9/11 or Al-Qaeda or Osama bin Laden at all. And so he was kind of a hero to many people on the left. But as time has gone by, whoo boy, has he gone, he's lost it. I mean, this is, you almost wonder, like, are you on something, Keith? Are you on something? That's the first question. And then if the answer is no, should you be on something? Should we hit homie off with prescription or Prozac or whatever the hell, because he certainly acts like he needs it. All right, now final point, And I can't get through the segment without bringing this up. Even though he's cringe, even though he's unhinged, even though it's an epic tantrum, even though it's a fit and a meltdown. He's right on the substance of this case. Okay, so here, 14th Amendment, Section 3. This is what Trump violated. Let's read it. No person shall be a senator or representative in Congress or elector or president and vice president or hold any office, civil or military, under the United States or under any state who, having previously taken an oath as a member of Congress or as an officer of the United States or as a member of any state legislature or as an executive or judicial officer of any state to support the Constitution of the United States shall have engaged in insurrection or rebellion against the same or given aid or comfort to the enemies thereof. But Congress may, by a vote of 2/3 of each house, remove such disability. So what they said is, this is what the Supreme Court said. They didn't answer one way or the other if it was an insurrection or if it wasn't. They just totally dodged that completely. And what they said is, this is the wrong decision because the burden would actually be on Congress to say that Trump can't run because he violated the insurrection clause. That's what they said. Now, I just read this amendment to you. Pause it and read it again if you don't understand what I'm about to say, because what I'm about to say is inarguable. They just made that up. They made it up that Congress has to be the one to say you can't do it. What it actually says in the amendment, the last line is, but Congress may, by a vote of 2/3 of each house, remove such disability. So in other words, what could theoretically happen is you have the state of Colorado, the state of Maine, the state of Illinois, some others said Trump can't run. He did an insurrection. If Congress wants to come up with a piece of legislation in response to what those states did, and they say, we're overriding that. He is allowed on the ballot. That would be allowed. But you'd need a vote of 2/3. You can't do it with a simple majority. That's what the amendment says. The amendment doesn't say the original decision to get him off the ballot has to come from Congress. That is utterly made up. Totally made up. Shameless. And by the way, the original decision in some of these cases, the judges were very clear to lay out, if you believe in textualism, if you believe in originalism, in other words, the plain face reading of the Constitution and what the founders meant is how we should interpret it. If you believe that, you have to side with the people who are kicking him off the ballot. You have to do it. So what they did is a Weasley dodge. That's what it was. What they should have done is wait in and conclusively and definitively answer whether or not it was an insurrection or not just an insurrection, or that Trump was giving, quote, aid or comfort to the enemies who were doing the insurrection. They should have weighed in on that. And they should have let it stand, because again, they made up what's in this amendment. So, from a legal perspective, I think they got it dead wrong. And there's some other people who say, well, he wasn't convicted for insurrection, so how does this apply? Read the amendment. Doesn't say anything about how he has to have a conviction of doing an insurrection. So they made it up, and they made it up because they didn't want to, you know, leave their mark on history as aggressively as to side with some states kicking somebody off of a ballot. And it's a chicken shit decision. It's not based on the plain face reading of the law. And it's kind of an embarrassment. And it's a shame that the person who's the biggest cheerleader against the Supreme Court on this is Keith Olbermann, because he does not make my side look good. He looks unhinged and silly, and he's talking about urine on people's faces. So to this point, Donald Trump hasn't really said much about what's going on in Gaza since the Israeli destruction of Gaza began. He hasn't said much. I mean, in the wake of October 7th, he said some stuff about October 7th, but he's largely been silent. And my guess is that was kind of strategic, because he sees how there's a tremendous amount of backlash over what Joe Biden is doing, and Joe Biden is losing a lot of his own base because of what he's doing here. This is what the uncommitted vote campaign is about. But thankfully, we got a moment here where Trump was asked on the record, hey, what do you think about what's going on there? And then what Trump does is removes any doubt whatsoever about whether or not, and I can't believe I still hear this argument to this day, he's an anti-war candidate. I still hear people say, anti-war. Trump is anti-war. He's the peace candidate. If you believe that, you're simply not going based off the record, not going based off his actions, not going based off what he says. Okay? It's inconceivable to call him anti-war. So now you're going to get a sense of what his position is on Israel and Gaza. And guess what? It's hideous.
Can we talk about your policies for a second? As you know, this president of the United States, when it comes to Israel, is getting protested. Now he seems to be turning on Israel. But with the non-committed vote that Biden's getting, they're not going to like you either because you are firmly in Israel's camp, correct? Are you on board with the way the IDF is taking the fight to in Gaza?
You've got to finish the problem.
Asked if he's on board with what the IDF is doing in Gaza, he says, quote, "You got to finish the problem." So, Don, are you talking about, say, a final solution? You need a final solution?
The way the IDF is taking the fight to in Gaza?
You've got to finish the problem. You had a horrible invasion. It took place. It would have never happened if I was president, by the way. As you know, Iran was broke, Brian. They were broke. They had no money for Hamas, for Hezbollah. They were broke. This would have never happened. And for another reason, they wouldn't have done it to me. I guarantee you that.
Trump moved the embassy to Jerusalem. Trump did the Abraham Accords. The whole point of the Abraham Accords is to normalize relations between Israel and other Arab countries in the region. The whole point of it is a giant middle finger to Palestinians to say, you don't count, you don't matter. We're going to prove to you that you don't count and you don't matter, and nobody's going to help you with your problem. Well, guess what? That was one of the catalysts which led to October 7th. It was Trump's actions, moving the embassy to Jerusalem and doing the Abraham Accords, which helped spark October 7th, where Palestinians said, Hamas said, oh, we're going to remind the world that we matter. We're going to remind the world that you can't work around us. And he's out here saying, like, it wouldn't have happened. It happened in part because of you. Jesus Christ.
Did this because they have no respect for Biden. And frankly, they got soft. And what happened here is incredible. That should never have happened. Likewise, Russia would never have attacked Ukraine. Never. You know it. Everybody knows it. And that wouldn't have happened.
A long-standing political disagreement and crisis. I mean, Vladimir Putin literally said in his speech when he announced the invasion, he said, effectively, we don't think Ukraine is a real country. We want to reconstitute effectively what was the Russian Empire. It's a fake country. It's ours. He has all this backstory and all this meticulous, skewed history that he believes in to justify and rationalize taking it by force. And you think that you get to override all of that? God, he has one move. His move is, let me suck myself off and act like everything under Biden and Democrats, horrible, terrible, nothing good ever happens. Worst president ever. I'm the best president ever. It's like a first grader's way of discussing politics. Under me, everything's great. Nothing bad ever happens. Under him, everything bad happens. It's like, are you even trying? This is so low effort.
Everybody knows it, and that wouldn't have happened. This is all on Biden.
Do you think the president's in the process of abandoning Israel?
I do believe that.
Do you think the president is in the process of abandoning Israel? I do believe that, he said. Joe Biden has given Israel a complete and utter green light. He's arming Israel. He's funding Israel. He's protecting them at the UN from any semblance of any condemnation whatsoever. The problem with Joe Biden is he's far too sycophantic to Netanyahu and the Israeli government and the extreme psychopaths who are trying to resettle Gaza and ethnically cleanse the Palestinians. And Trump flips it. Yeah, Biden's too weak. He's not pro-Israel enough. This is his argument. You gonna say this guy's anti-war? My ass cheeks, man. Holy shit.
Do you think the president's in the process of abandoning Israel?
I do believe that, but I don't think he knows where he is, frankly. I think you could ask him a question right now, ask him the same question. I don't think he knows what to say about many subjects, actually. So, it's really the people that surround him. It's the fascists and the communists that surround him. They're making the calls. They're calling the shots. He's not calling the shots.
Mr. President, what did you feel about Kamala Harris calling for a ceasefire in Gaza? Is that something that you support? Is that something that is totally off the table right now for you?
Look, I hate seeing what's happening. Again, it would have never happened. This attack on Israel and likewise Israel's counterattack, which is what it is, would never have happened if I was president. And you know that, Lawrence. This would have never happened. And it's so horrible to watch it.
All right. There you go. So he said, quote, "You've got to finish the problem," when asked about the IDF's actions in Gaza. And he makes very clear that he's in favor of the carnage and the brutality. Here, one more time.
This is all on Biden.
Do you think the president's in the process of abandoning Israel?
I do believe that.
So Biden's abandoning Israel. He's too weak. He doesn't support them enough. And the IDF needs to, quote, finish the problem. Guys, it's what we saw in the first term, right? He surrounded himself with neocon John Bolton, with neocon torturer Gina Haspel. And he was incredibly hawkish. He increased drone strikes by over 400%. He kept us in Iraq and Afghanistan. He assassinated General Soleimani, a top Iranian commander, who was on the ground fighting ISIS, by the way. So we were acting as de facto the air force for ISIS. Trump tried to coup Venezuela. He ripped up the Iran agreement, an agreement they were following to a T. He pulled out of the Paris Climate Accord. He says he wants war with Mexico. He wants to designate the cartels as terrorists, and then we would allow us to do airstrikes. He armed Saudi Arabia, as they did a genocide in Yemen. And as we already discussed, he did the Abraham Accords, which was a massive middle finger to the Palestinians, and he moved the embassy, which was a massive middle finger to the Palestinians. So his record is one of hawkishness. And he's making very clear here that he would either do exactly what Biden is doing, or he would go further in supporting Israel because Biden's looking like he's going to abandon Israel. And he would tell the IDF, you got to finish the job. So, look, we don't have to guess, right? We don't have to guess. We saw what happened when a top ally of ours was committing a genocide. Yemen. Saudi Arabia is doing a genocide in Yemen with our funding and our arms. And what did Trump do? He vetoed a bipartisan bill that was passed with, I believe it was Bernie Sanders and Senator Mike Lee. He vetoed a bill which would have stopped U.S. support for Saudi Arabia as they do a genocide in Yemen. Would have cut off the money and the arms. It passed in the Senate. Trump vetoed it. Why? Because he's cucked to Saudi Arabia. They have all these financial dealings. Same thing goes with Israel. He would do the same thing. If there was a permanent ceasefire bill that came out tomorrow and it passed both houses of Congress, Trump would veto it. It's a very, very similar circumstance to how he acted vis-a-vis Yemen and Saudi Arabia. And look, he's telling you in no uncertain terms. That's what he's doing here. So people need to wake up as to what it would be like under him. This is not in any way, shape, or form to excuse Biden's horrific actions. It's just to make crystal clear for everybody, the idea that Trump would be better is beyond ludicrous. All right, guys, that's the show. I love you all very much. Everybody, please subscribe to the channel. It helps out massively. You could also click that bell icon so that you get a notification every time a video drops. You can click that like button, leave a comment, all that fun stuff. Thank you to everybody who supports this show on Patreon. We couldn't do it without you. That link is below, or you could tip with the thanks button on YouTube. Crystal Kyle and friends this week will be a reaction to the State of the Union address. We got the State of the Union. Oh boy, Biden better pack up on that Adderall, bro. He's going to need it. So, bunch of stuff to look forward to. All right, guys, have a great rest of your day, and I'll talk to you tomorrow.